Welcome to Exploration 1. I believe we're up to Lecture 7. I'll have to check that. It's 7, I think. And anyway, I will edit on the lecture number on the start of the lecture when I find out what it is. Okie dokie. So, today we are going to go back to lecturing about stuff out of the notes. As we have a fairly low attendance today, I can't see the point of going through subnetting and then having to go through it again when everybody is actually here. So, rather than go through subnetting, we're going to talk about the network layer. Can anybody tell me which layer of the OSI reference model? Yes, Grace, you are actually dobbed in for answering questions here. Possibly because that we have
which layer number are we on?
The network layer?
3.
Anyone else want to argue about 3?
3's good.
Ah, good. Yes, she was just checking with please do not throw sausage pizza away. We had pizza last night for dinner. It was good, too.
Oh, it's fantastic.
It happened to be sausage.
Okay, maybe Conrad doesn't like pizza.
I think it's not a problem.
Yeah, you're probably right. Okay. Okay, let's maximize the notepad window in order to make reading my notes easier. Okay, as we spoke about at each of the layers of the OSI reference model, we have a particular PDUs or protocol data units. At the bottom layer of the network, at the OSI reference model, in other words, at the physical layer, we have bits. Can either of you tell me what the next PDU is up the stack from bits?
Frames?
Yeah, okay. Anyone know what the one for the network network layer is?
No idea.
Is it packets?
It's packets. Yes, it is. It's packets. Because the packets go into frames when they go on the Ethernet, and then the segments go into packets when they go on the network layer. And there is actually a question on this in the final, so it's very important to understand data, segment, packets, frames, bits. Data, segments, packets, frames, bits are the layers down the model, or bits, frames, packets, segments, data, if you want to go back the other way. Very important to know, so that you know which bits you're talking about. When we talk about frames, we're usually talking about layer 2 PDUs, so we're talking about things like Ethernet, wireless network, etc. If we talk about packets, we are talking about layer 3, or the network layer, and if we are talking about segments, we are talking about the transport layer. Okay.
You know, at some point we're going to have to come up with a semi-dirty mnemonic for that so that people remember.
No, I'm just going to keep saying it, and then people will either go insane or memorize it. I mean, if somebody can come up with a mnemonic for bits, frames, packets, segments, data, I'm not even going to make one up because it'll probably be risque and we'll move on. But somebody could come up with something for that. So it encapsulates the segments into packets for transmission over the network. So when we're talking about packets, we're talking about the things that usually go over your local area network, the ones that are encapsulated that go from you to the internet, that sort of thing. And we're talking about the things that go over the internet, such as ping packets, TCP packets, UDP packets, etc. This layer is responsible for performing addressing, encapsulation, as we've already spoken about, routing happens at the network layer, decapsulation, which is what happens at the other end when it gets there, and they are the things that happen on that layer. So encapsulation is, as I said, putting the segments into packets, and the decapsulation is putting the packets back into segments at the other end. So that's why we've got encapsulation and decapsulation at that particular layer. As we know, addressing at the network layer, if we're discussing TCP IP, you're looking at IP addresses which are 32 bits long, and they are a 32-bit number, as we spoke about last week. And when a device has an address at the network layer, it's called host. Very important term, a host. Not something that holds onto a parasite and stuff. That's a different sort of host. This is a network host. So obviously, that's why you get errors such as host unreachable, network unreachable, etc. etc. That's all right. Ian's Mac is ringing and has no chance of being answered.
That was my...
What'd you do that for?
I didn't mean to do it.
Oh. That's odd. Who were you trying to call?
I wasn't.
Oh.
I got a weird... I think I got a contact request and I hit the button and it called him instead of accepting the contact request.
Okay. All right. So when layer 3 is encapsulated, source and destination network addresses are added. So obviously after that happens, it is sent down to the data link layer for transmission across the particular medium. So we're talking about Ethernet frames, we're talking about PPPoE packets if you are using ADSL or PPPoE, which is actually point-to-point protocol encapsulated in ATM or Ethernet frames, which is what the O and the A stand for. Why do they encapsulate PPP in ATM or Ethernet frames, I hear you ask? It's so that they can handle their accounting. If you're using a point-to-point connection between you and your ISP, you can actually then authenticate the PPP with a RADIUS server, which stands for Remote Authentication Dial-in User Service. I love expanding that acronym because it's so cool. Remote Authentication Dial-in User Service is RADIUS. Once you've authenticated with your ISP, you send and receive data. And then once you've done that, I'm just going to mute my main session. Oh no, global session mute, there we go. Once you actually receive and transmit your data, the ISP can then monitor you on the volume that you use. I live in the US, why should I care, I hear you all ask. Sadly, soon you will. I believe that there is currently some argumentation going on at the moment as to whether volume charging is going to come in and at what extent it's going to come in. They're looking at putting 250 gig soft caps on certain accounts, and if you exceed the 250 gig soft cap three times, there may be consequences, but nobody's really sure yet.
I actually read an article about it. It's going to be for Comcast customers at least, it's $150 on regular DSL, $250 on their UVerse. If you go over that cap three times, they will charge you $10 for 50 additional gigs.
So there you go. Just another reason why you shouldn't sign up with Comcast. We have all sorts of trouble with our mail servers being blocked by Comcast because they don't like us. And then you go round and round in circles in their server systems trying to unblock your mail server because it didn't do anything wrong. The other thing...
We only have Comcast or Comcast, so...
But you've got a Gmail address, so that sort of mitigates that one to a degree. The other problem, of course, is, what is actually starting to happen, and this is a problem for the Americans, is mobile plans are being capped. Mobile data, you're looking at, 5, 10 gig allowances. And as everybody starts dragging around iPhones and Windows 7 phones and Droid phones and things that want to use the network on we are going to see increased utilization of the mobile networks, which will mean that the mobile networks will either have to improve their infrastructure and or cap the usage of users. Apparently, they don't want you watching YouTube on your phone too much. And I think, unless you're very lucky, you usually end up on a contract with iPhone anyway, over in the States, unless you really work hard to avoid it, and they tend to have data limits. Okay, the network layer must also route data. Some people say route, some people say route. We don't tend to say route over here because it tends to mean something else. We would rather route packets in Australia. If you've got some seasoned network administrators, you can get away with it once we've all stopped snickering about it. After the joke is 10 years old, you can do whatever you want to your packets, but we'll be routing them today. Now, each route a packet travels through is called a hop, because, I don't know, picture a kangaroo hopping from router to router. It's probably not the... Well, it's probably good enough. A rabbit, something else that hops. So obviously when you do a trace RT, which you would have done in the earlier labs of the chapter, you end up with the first hop being your ADSL router, your cable router, your whatever it is you happen to have stuck in your wall, and then the next one's your ISP, and so on to the destination, and each of those is known as a hop. Historically, and this is just of historical interest, but I mention it anyway because that's the sort of person I am. Sorry? Ignore the missed call from Grace.
Yeah, that was
Grace rang it by mistake. Yeah, you're right. Okay, they were just winding our boss up. It doesn't work very well, but we do it anyway. Historically, the TTL, which is known as the time to live, now the time to live is a field in each IP packet, which is decremented by one each time the packet travels through a router, or at least that's theoretically what's supposed to happen, unless the router in question breaks the rules, which some of them do. Historically, the TTL was originally set to 30, which means that if you were more than 30 hops away from something, the destination was considered unreachable. I believe it was Windows 95 that upped the TTL to 64, or was it Windows 98? And it was, I think the TTL is now set at 255 under Windows XP. Oh, I can find out. Here we go. I'm just pinging www.qcat.org. Oh, no, the TTL is only set to 64. Okay, so I was incorrect. If things are a long way away from you, there are actually registry fiddles and stuff you can do to up the TTL, or the time to live. I think generally it's considered if things are more than 64 hops away from you, you're doing unusual things, and you probably do have to go in and twiddle the registry. What's a TTL on Windows 7, Grace? Can you ping www.qcat and tell me what you get back at some point?
Yep.
And I wonder if I need to move Brian or whether he's going to come down of his own volition.
Ah, ping it?
Just ping www.qcat.org and tell me what the TTL you get back is. Because I'm seeing whether they've upped it. I'm seeing whether they've upped it in Windows 7. That's what I was trying to ascertain. Good morning, evening, Brian.
Evening.
TTL to 64.
Okay. We're doing the network layer, which is notes on module 6. We're just theorising that they might be using the DOS 3.3 version of Ping in Windows still. We were just ascertaining that the TTL on Windows 7 is still set to 64. And we were just talking about the TTL, which is decremented each time the packet travels through a router, except when the router breaks the rules. Can anybody tell me, does anybody know, what is the point of the TTL? What is it meant to prevent? I'll give you a clue. It's not students not passing the exploration course. It's a different answer.
I don't know. Drop packets? I don't know.
Packets that get stuck forever trying to reach your destination and go on and on and on and on and on.
That is correct. It's meant to detect routing loops. So if you send a packet from router 1, who sends it to router 2, who sends it to router 3, who sends it to router 1, who then sends it to router 2, who sends it to router 3, and so on, and it goes round and round and round, there is actually the potential for a packet to continually go round and round forever. And that's what the TTL is meant to mitigate. And the TTL is also used by the traceroute command, but we don't quite go into that at this particular point. Examples of network protocols are IPv4, IPv6, IPX-SPX, AppleTalk, and DECnet. Okay, so DECnet isn't as common as it once was, but back in 1995 I used to see a fair bit of it. IPv4 is connectionless. In other words, it doesn't usually establish a connection between source and destination. This is IP we're talking about. It's best effort and it's media independent. Media independent means that it doesn't really matter what sort of media the packets are being shoveled over. So IP itself doesn't concern itself whether it's running on fiber, copper cable, wireless, etc. IP is not reliable. It's up to the upper level protocols such as TCP that operate at the transport layer to maintain reliability. So at the IP layer, we are not concerning ourselves with reliability. That said, it's a very high percentage, up in the high 90s, probably 99.9% of packets that actually do make it through, depending on your network. And then you go to Curtin University, and that's not true. Okay. Network hosts are separated into groups to make them manageable. Can anybody come up with an idea of what sort of groups we might separate hosts into? What sort of things would separate networks into groups? What sort of boundaries we could do that separation on? Anyone?
Lots of times it's physical, like specific buildings, specific enterprises. Typically, though, even an enterprise within buildings will have separate lands.
Yeah, you're generally looking at subnetting on administrative boundaries, so the accounting section and the propeller heads and whoever else. And then if you've got multiple businesses that have networking infrastructure in the same building, they will tend to be on their own subnets. Subgroups of network hosts are called subnets. This is very important, and it's what we were talking about last week, how you break networks into subnetworks and how you go about allocating these scarce things that we call IPv4 addresses. We actually had a council that I worked for, I'm not going to say which one, and they decided that because they really didn't know how to subnet, because they hadn't paid me lots of money to come up and teach them yet, they were just going to put all of their stuff on a 10 network, and then they were just going to make numbers up so that one council could be 10.10 and the other one could be 10.20 and the other one could be 10.18 and this other one that we just put in could be 10.16. And then they tried doing their routing with RIP version 1, which does not send the subnet mask with the routing updates. So the entire council network that consisted of 7 county councils was seen as one logical subnet. Bad times. We ended up going to RIP version 2, which does send the subnet mask, although we seriously should have moved to a smaller network prefix. If somebody is subnetting a network of 10 machines and they just tell you that they're going to stick it on 10 dot whatever because it doesn't really matter and you're paying them to subnet, run very fast in the other direction. Okay, so you're looking at groups by ownership, location, and purpose, which we have covered. If you've got, say, for example, a subclass of stuff on your network that is actually high bandwidth using, for example, graphic design or similar, sometimes you might want to put those on their own subnet and their own switching infrastructure, and that way they don't have to impact the entire network. It's an issue of quality of service. Has anybody been in one of those organizations where people insist on emailing around 20 meg pictures of the dog that is going to the pound this afternoon to all 200 employees? Not only do you run out of space on the mail server, but this is very heavy on your network resources. And unfortunately, the dog doesn't usually get saved because nobody ever gets the email. Anyone experience problems with attachment limits in an organization?
I've experienced it just on regular home email.
Was that here or was that...
Oh, no, not here.
Sorry, go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, a lot of the ISPs here have, you know, if you get an attachment, anything over 5 megs, they'll just stop it.
There is actually some method in that madness, and you might sort of think, well, why would they do it now that we've got high-speed networks and incredibly fast DSL and whatever else? Now, whilst you would hope that they would not still be running it, there probably are people who are running Outlook Express, okay? There are probably still quite a few of them out there that... I mean, I used to like Outlook Express. I will put my hand up and say that I enjoyed Outlook Express. Grace?
Yep.
If you
it was far better than any of the current Windows built-in alternatives.
Yeah, pretty much. And I'm not a big fan of the current Windows inbuilt ones, and there are some problems with Windows Live Mail and Windows Mail and stuff. Obviously they work, but they are a bit of a challenge. Obviously you've got to look at sort of, you know, Outlook Express, people are still running it. Has anyone ever seen when you send a big message to Outlook Express and your whole machine appears to latch up as your mail is then slowly shoveled upstream to your ISP's mail server? Has anybody experienced this phenomenon where you sort of attached 10 meg and then didn't think about it and then sort of thought again and thought that maybe Dropbox would have been a good idea, but that didn't exist last year or the year before?
Yeah, it gets real slow. The other thing is if you ever try and have compact a DBX file that's larger than a gig, they quite often break and you get to keep a lot of broken pieces. They're quite difficult to reconstruct and put back together.
Yeah, and that is a big problem for people using POP. Well, it's a big problem for people using any sort of email accounts, especially when mail folders grow fairly large. The other problem with email is that if you're sending email in big chunks, you would tend to find that there is no resume. So once you start retrieving a message from the POP server, you either have to finish the retrieve of that single message or abort it. Now, if you're receiving 5 meg on a mobile data connection, then you could be there for quite some time. And you'll find that with things like IMAP, it actually fetches the headers down first, and then it doesn't actually fetch the message body unless you ask for it. Otherwise, you'd run out of iPhone data real quick. And yes, putting mail folders and stuff back together after the fact is not very pleasant. Out of morbid curiosity, and this is a yes-no question, you don't actually have to tell a story if you don't want to, Brian, did you end up getting the stuff back off your IMAP server?
I did. What I did, it was very strange. I couldn't get it back. I called them and I said, listen, you know, you're providing an IMAP server. 500 messages shouldn't just go away. I mean, I realized that you have disclaimers in your terms of service that if this happens, it's not our problem. but it shouldn't happen. Strangely enough, I was setting up Outlook 2010 to train someone, because they asked me a question about using it with JAWS, and by God, I hate Outlook even more now than I did ever before. And it imported a PST from my 2007, which had my work account as a POP account. And for some strange reason, when Outlook 2010 fired up, it retrieved all of my messages that weren't there in my IMAP folder. So I'm very baffled, but I then very quickly proceeded to tell Thunderbird that it should scoop all the data from Outlook, and it worked. It copied everything nicely back into my inbox.
Excellent. Well, that's a happy story of IMAP recovery. Sometimes they're not that happy. So if you've got important email and stuff, you should probably back it up. Now, there's a number of ways of doing that. If you're Brian, you store your Thunderbird profile in your Dropbox. And hey, if you're paid for one of those big Dropboxes, you might as well, if you're not on bandwidth caps or shoveling things up and down is not a problem. We did actually have an instance where somebody wanted to store their iTunes library in their Dropbox, and I sort of jumped up and down and said, not until you've land-synced it between the machines you're carrying around, because otherwise it will do in our monthly bandwidth cap at work. So, interesting times. Obviously if you're holidaying in Australia, check out how much you got in your Dropbox and use Selective Sync, which is in the new version of Dropbox. Okay. Now, obviously, large numbers of hosts can impact the performance of the network, such as broadcast storms. Now, broadcast storm is where you've got lots and lots of broadcasts being generated by hosts, either for NetBIOS name resolution or similar. I just want to ask a question before he wanders off. Has anybody else seen this, actually, while I'm mentioning it, because I've obviously stayed keyed up? Has anybody seen the one where if there's no text around the radio buttons and you go onto a website, JAWS doesn't show the radio buttons up at all unless you use the JAWS cursor? Yes, we know Grace has seen it because she does surveys. Anybody else seen this behaviour? If you actually get to sit the expiration final, you'll get to see this unless we get it fixed before you do. And the question sort of says, which depicts the cable used to connect a router to a PC? And then it just goes on to the next question. Unless you use your JAWS cursor or Window Eyes or NVDA or some other sort of screen reader, and we think it's a problem with the lack of text sitting around the radio buttons. That's my current theory. The radio buttons actually disappear. Very strange.
Is it browser specific, or does it happen with
I think it's browser specific. I think it might be an IE thing. I could try it in Firefox, but I've always noticed it in IE.
That's probably worth testing, actually, at some point. I don't know whether we can still re-enable that assessment to have a look, but I mean, I don't enjoy Firefox much, but it might be a solution. I don't like the way Firefox handles its break tags and stuff, and sometimes it'll read a paragraph as if there's absolutely no gaps in it, and then it goes on and on, and then you press the down arrow and then it jumps a really long way down the screen because there's obviously lots of stuff in the paragraph that somebody hasn't formatted properly. But it does have WebVism, so it could be a solution. We might try and test that and see if it works better. But it does work okay with NVDA, and it does work okay with Window Eyes, and it probably works okay with System Access. So we're actually trying to track down what they've done that breaks this, because I was trying to mark a test a few weeks ago and I couldn't actually see the radio buttons. So, interesting times. We hope to have it fixed, or at least workarounds in place by the time you guys get going through the final.
Because I did a one of the ITE module exam questions was like that, where the I maybe it wasn't there, but I think it was, where I had to actually count radio buttons. Now I was using WindowEyes and Firefox, but it was like, oh, you know what it was? It was the evaluation questions. What is no actual text. They're just a group of radio buttons, and you have to sort of remember that one is very motivated, two is somewhat motivated, or however it went. Following that was radio button, radio button, radio button, radio. And, I mean, I did it with WindowEyes and Firefox, but actually most of the exams now at the end have these evaluation questions, and they all seem to be formatted like that.
Yeah, we'll certainly raise that with them as well, because that's certainly a problem. I mean, it may look messier to actually have the text next to the radio buttons, but I'm thinking maybe they just should. I know Grace gets a lot of this in a survey work where they've got, you know, one is mostly disagree and five is jubilantly mind-bogglingly agree, bouncing up and down in absolute ecstasy, and then that's all you ever see, and then there are five radio buttons that give you the extremes in between that. So it's probably something we'll raise as an issue as well. We're also going to try and push as much as possible for as many questions that don't just have pictorial answers, or at least have the images numbered to make the diagram descriptions a bit easier. Okay, back to the lecture per se, although that is kind of important, because you guys, if you guys come across any of this in the chapter exams, please let me know, because they've updated the forms to Form O, and they may have some nasties in the chapter exam, and we can certainly do things about it in the chapter exam. It's harder to do things about it in the final, so do let us know if you come across it. Now, a broadcast domain is the domain in which a network-wide broadcast is relevant. Now, obviously, if you are going to send a packet to the Ethernet broadcast address, it will be an address of all ones, so it'll be FF colon FF colon FF colon FF colon FF colon FF. And generally you see broadcasts on a particular IP subnet. So if we have the IP subnet 192.168.1.0/24, broadcasts on that network will be sent to 192.168.1.255. Broadcasts are used for things such as NetBIOS resolution if you're not using WINS, NTP time broadcasts. The Dropbox LAN sync protocol is another thing that uses broadcasts, and bits and pieces of other information, DHCP discover messages, etc. A router segments a network into broadcast domains. So if you've got two subnets, one on one side of your router of 192.168.1, and 192.168.2 on the other side of your router, you will end up with two broadcast domains, because a network-wide broadcast will only show up on one side of the router, not the other. Obviously, if you tell your router to forward broadcasts, then that can cause all sorts of interesting problems. Careful doing that, because you may end up with a broadcast storm. So are we going to say something, or just making noise?
No.
Okay. Sorry, you want to say something, Brian, or...
Yeah, I'm a bit confused with that. Why do they mention that as opposed to just acknowledging that there is a broadcast address on each subnet? Is there a specific... I mean, in theory, you shouldn't be able to broadcast... You know, if in a network has a broadcast address, and likely you're not going to broadcast outside of that, so I'm not... I don't follow why this is a separate concept from having a... broadcast address in a network, and maybe it's just because I'm very tired and my brain is kind of half mushed.
Well, that's okay, and perhaps you won't be the only one that doesn't understand this, so even if you are tired, and I completely respect that, because I saw your day on Twitter yesterday and went, hey, he can have that. Basically, the reason why there are certain protocols such as NetBIOS name resolution protocol, where you have two subnets and they're separated by a router, and you want the machines on one side of the network subnet to be seen on the other side of the subnet so that the work group that you've got that's spread across both sides of the router can all see each other's names in that stupid My Network Places window that when it breaks it seems to be the end of the world because we can't go // server name because that's too hard. And to make that work, you actually have to do what we call broadcast forwarding, and you actually have to forward selectively the broadcasts over to the other subnet so that the NetBIOS resolution will actually pick them up. Now, the other thing to keep in mind is that if you do a network-specific broadcast, so if you broadcast to 192.168.1.255, you'll get to everything on the 192.168.1 network. If you send to the non-network specific broadcast address of 255.255.255.255, for example, if you are doing DHCP, the DHCP discover message is sent to the non-network specific broadcast address, you can either use relay agents to forward the DHCP onto other subnets, or you can actually forward those non-network specific broadcasts to see them on the other subnets. Now, that's not actually officially in your notes, but I thought it was worth mentioning. Yeah.
Is that how the beginning of DHCP works? Like if some, you know, if some machine comes up and says, oh, I better request IP information, it sends out a broadcast packet?
It certainly does. The first packet on a DHCP exchange is a discover from the MAC address of the machine that wants the address to the non-specific broadcast address 255.255.255.255. The DHCP server then sends an offer to that workstation based on its MAC address, and then the workstation then sends a request packet back to the DHCP server, and then the DHCP server then sends an acknowledge packet. And I've got ideas of actually setting up a Wireshark lab that will demonstrate those phases of DHCP, which could be a bit of fun. I might write up a supplemental lab so that we can play with that. But yes, the first packet goes to the non-network specific broadcast. Because the machine can't know what network it is on already, it has to send to the non-specific network, the all networks broadcast address. Alrighty. Now, obviously, there is a difference between a broadcast domain and a collision domain. A collision domain is where you've got the logical bus topology, and you're likely to actually see collisions. These are obviously mitigated by installing a switch or similar. However, a broadcast domain is usually limited to an IP subnet. And broadcast domains are sliced up using routers. And yes, there are questions in the final that ask you to actually look at a diagram description and figure out how many collision domains you have. Any other questions before we move on? Okie dokie. Firewalls aid security on networks. They limit packet flow, they limit what sort of stuff can go in, they limit what sort of stuff can go out. We had an interesting situation at a site once where 3 minutes after you turned the router on, it would crash. And then you would turn it off, and then you would turn it back on again, and 3 minutes later, it would crash. And we thought, well, this is probably a dodgy router. No, it turned out that a couple of the machines on the network had spyware that was all trying to phone home at the same time very, very quickly and was running the router out of network address translation resources and crashing it. So, if your router continually crashes and you can't blame your ISP, you might want to have a look in its list of connections and see whether there are too many connections in there for what you expect. You know, are we looking at 2,000 connections? Are we looking at 200 connections? Are we looking at 100 connections? Obviously, if you are torrenting, you can expect a couple of hundred connections. You probably shouldn't be looking at a couple of thousand. I mean, obviously, we all want to get the new release of Ubuntu when it first comes out, and the most efficient way of doing that is through torrents. Okay, dividing networks, except I can't spell, that's okay, up allows hosts to not need to know all addresses. In other words, if you can subnet things onto smaller subnets and stuff, the hosts can know about the things on their particular subnets, and they can handle send the work for sending things to other subnets off to other routers to forward and deal with. It's worth mentioning that most home networks tend to have one subnet, which is obviously run through a network address translator. And the packets are then forwarded to your router, which is then responsible for getting the packets out to the internet. So your router is your default gateway, and you actually have that router is then responsible for getting stuff out to the big wide world. I did actually used to run a network where I actually had two gateways on that network. One of them went over a modem link, and the other one went over a different modem link, actually. And you could actually use either, depending on what speed and that sort of thing you wanted and what bandwidth caps you had. And we actually had route costs and stuff in there to actually tell it when to use either of the two links out of an organization. Your default gateway is the machine... Sorry, go ahead.
No, keep going. It's all right.
Oh, okay. The default gateway is the way off your current network. If you do not have a default gateway set, you cannot communicate outside the local network. There are questions in the final about what is the problem with this network configuration, and you have to look at gateways and stuff and see whether the gateways are reachable. It is important that the address of your gateway be on a subnet that your network card is capable of reaching, unless the link you are dealing with is a point-to-point link, i.e. one of those funny ones that gets brought up by some of those single-port, two-wire modem things. Okay. Hierarchical addressing uses routing to get stuff across network boundaries. So as the larger networks tend to route to the smaller networks, and then the smaller networks route to the smaller networks, and depending on how the subnetting is done, you route down to the biggest network that you can get to, and then that network figures out where the packets needs to go inside it, and then it goes down to smaller networks, and it goes down to smaller networks. So that is your hierarchical routing. If we run an example of that, your tier 1 providers will handle the packets between, say, America and Australia and all that sort of stuff. Then when it gets to Australia, the ISP networks will look at it, and it will get handed to the network of your ISP, which then figures out where you are and hands it down to you specifically. And generally speaking, most people only have one address allocated by their ISP unless they're doing something special. Okay, there are two types of routes. Routes need to know how to get to other devices on the network. A static route is a route that is configured in the TCP/IP stack, and it's configured by the administrator or by software, and it is a route that is put in statically. In other words, it does not change unless programmatically told to do so. A dynamic route is a route that is added by a routing protocol such as RIP, BGP, OSPF, etc., which are all known as routing protocols. So when routers communicate to each other, they can learn about other routers, and they can build a dynamic routing table that will tell them what other routers exist on the internet work, given which links are up and which links are down, etc. Anybody got any comments, questions, things they want to add in? Alrighty. Now, generally when you look at a route, it has a destination address, it has a subnet mask for that destination address, and it has a next hop, which is where it's going to go, and it has a metric as to how expensive that route is. So if we were to open a command prompt, for example, and do a route print, it will actually show you a whole series of routes. So I've got a route here, for example, that says, let me find one. Ah, here we are. 192.168.100.0 with a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0. The source address for that route is 192.168.100.132, which is my workstation address. It's got that twice because it's bound to that interface, and it has a metric of 10, and that is an example of a route. There are also routes in here for the localhost address, there's stuff for the multicast and stuff like that. So that's route print if you would like to have a look at your routing table. Route space print space greater than route.txt if you would like to look at your routing table in Notepad or something a bit nicer. And would you believe it, that's all we have for that chapter. Is there any questions, queries, or anything anybody else would like to cover at this particular point in time before I hit stop on the record?